and welcome to the Etonicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy, here with my wonderful co-hosts, Kirsten Korosek and Edward Niedermeyer. And today we have a really great guest, old friend, although I think he's a little upset with me for giving him some grief, Samuel Abul Samad.
Just Sam.
Just Sam. He's a journalist and an analyst for Navigant Research, and is really unique in the sector because he's one of the few people writing an analysis about self-driving and automation and mobility who's also a real engineer, which gives him really great insight. Welcome so much, Sam.
Pleasure to join you guys today.
And the reason we're here this episode with Sam is because last week, Navigant Research published the self-driving leaderboard, which is published more than once a year. Is that right, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, typically when we do leaderboard reports in various sectors, they're usually about every 18 months or so. But in this case, because the automated driving space is moving so rapidly and there's so many things changing, we decided to do it on a little bit shorter schedule than normal. So it's been about 9 months since our last one. And as you can tell, you know, some things have changed.
A lot has changed. I mean, what makes this leaderboard so important is that it instantly becomes the source of almost every repost in the sector. You know, whoever you list as being in the lead, that becomes the story. And, you know, there are people, I'm one of them, who've kind of questioned some aspects of the methodology, not the research, because the research is obviously deep. But we really want to talk about some of the assumptions behind methodology and kind of, you know, how you came to some of these conclusions.
Sure. I give you credit. You know, you should always, anytime anybody publishes anything like this, you should always question the methodology. You may or may not agree with it. Everyone comes into something like this with their own biases, you know, and, you know, we try to be as objective as we can, at the work that we do at Navigant, but, there's always room for differing opinions. Let's put it that way.
Hang on, before we get into the methodology itself specifically, just sort of, can you tell us why do you do this report? Like, why is it important to rank these companies sort of just on a high level? What are you trying to accomplish with these reports?
What we typically do, you know, what most of our work is at Navigant Research, you know, we're a market research arm of Navigant Consulting. And, you know, we cover a bunch of areas. The company started, you know, focused on clean energy technologies. And, you know, we've expanded our scope over the years into technologies that impact energy use. And in this case, in transportation, I'm part of the transportation team and I lead our mobility research service. And so most of our reports are focused on particular technologies, looking at, how the technologies are developing, what are the market drivers, the issues, and we do forecasts of how we think that technology is going to develop in the marketplace. In addition to that, we periodically put out these leaderboard reports in particular sectors of interest. In this case, you know, it's automated driving. And what we do, you know, in our forecasts, we look at the technologies as a whole, how they're going to grow in the marketplace. And we don't specifically forecast what particular companies are doing, although we include profiles of the companies we think are key players in that segment. In the leaderboard reports, we take a look at, you know, who are these key players and what specifically are they doing, and kind of give our ranking of it, of which companies are most likely to succeed in this sector of the market, and why. And so that's what we've done here. You know, we score each of the, in this case, 19 companies that we scored officially on 10 different criteria related to their strategy and their execution. All of the scores are relative to the other companies. So if you're looking at the report from last year and looking at the report from this year, the numerical scores aren't directly comparable because they're relative scores, but they're, you know, the overall rankings, you can compare where companies, you know, move, if they moved up or down in the rankings overall. But the scores are relative in each of the criteria. And then we add it all up at the bottom and come up with the overall score of who's on top.
So Sam, I had a quick question for you in terms of that leaderboard, because I think it's important to think about, you know, is this a snapshot in time based on the methodology, the leaders you see in this moment, or is it the leaders you see in this moment based on where you believe they'll be 5 years from now? Are you freezing time and looking at it, or are you sort of saying these are the companies that are our best track right now to succeed in the future?
A little bit of both, more of the former. So it's definitely a snapshot in time. And, you know, part of why we, you know, we come back and revisit these is because the situation does change based on the decisions that these companies make. Based on, you know, where they are right now and what's happened over the past year, you know, we've scored them based on their likelihood to succeed in the automated driving space as a business overall. You know, so it goes beyond just the core technologies. Next time I come back to this report, you know, either maybe late this year or early next year, you know, the situation may change again, depending on the decisions that these various companies make, you know, over the next 6 to 12 months. So, you know, as an example, Waymo, you know, came out second overall this time around. They moved up from, I think, sixth last year. One of the main reasons why they did so much better is because they've been making progress both on the technology front, but also on the business side of it. You know, how are they going to commercialize this technology? And that's a big part of this. It's so of these reports, it goes beyond just the technology, but how are you going to make a business out of it? So, you know, among the commercialization things they've done, they launched their early rider program. They made set up deals with Avis and AutoNation to provide maintenance and repair services for their vehicle, for their fleet of vehicles. You know, so that's going to be a key component of operating a service going forward, is you have to have, you know, if these vehicles are going to be used for autonomous mobility services, they're going to need, you know, a lot of maintenance and repair because they're going to be high utilization. They're going to be accumulating miles rapidly, you know, 100, 200 miles a day or more in a mobility service. And so, you know, they're going to need, you know, even basic maintenance like, you know, tires and tire rotations and brake pads and all the other things that a car needs. But, you know, because they're accumulating the miles so much faster than a typical individual owner, the time period between those maintenance visits is going to be shorter. So things like that are parts of building out the business plan. And, you know, those are some of the things for some other companies, you know, where they don't have those mechanisms in place, you know, where they lack those components of a long-term business strategy, you know, may have pulled them down in the rankings.
Yeah, so this is one of the things, I know this report is always very controversial, but one of the things I really like about it is the fact that it does, you know, so much of the discourse around autonomous driving is just purely focused on the technological challenge of getting cars to drive themselves. These are all extremely important things. And they also, when you include more than just the technology, when you actually look at commercialization strategies, you see the Detroit automakers, you know, established automakers in general, doing as well or better than some of the Silicon Valley companies. I mean, people see these challenges differently. Some people, I think, see the commercialization challenge as being easier than just the technology challenge. What kind of feedback do you get in terms of how these things are relatively weighted? Like, basically, do you get a lot of angry email from people in Silicon Valley about this?
I get a few angry tweets, you know, from the likes of Ashley Vance and others that are fans of one particular company. But, you know, in general, you know, once people get a chance to, you know, understand the overall approach we've taken, you know, they generally, you know, while they may disagree with, you know, some of the individual scores, you know, or the criteria that we're looking at, you know, the general approach, you know, seems to make sense to most people. You know, once it's explained, then, you know, people generally tend to agree with that overall holistic approach to how we're taking a look at the business.
What do you say when people say, you know, well, the commercialization part is the easy part, right? Once you develop this technology, it will be easy to find a business model around this. And therefore, sort of like weighting these things equally, you know, it doesn't make sense, or it's biased, or whatever. What's your response to that?
How much profit did Uber earn last year, or Lyft, or for that matter, Tesla? Doing the software is, you know, the software for an automated driving system is a really difficult challenge. You know, and it's a critically important piece of this. But if you don't have vehicles to put it in, you know, it's just a bunch of code. building actual vehicles and getting them on the road and validating those vehicles, making sure that, you know, they can survive the rigors, especially of a life in fleet service, you know, where they're operating on city streets, you know, around lots of other vehicles, you know, dealing with potholes and weather and everything else. You know, all of these components are actually a lot harder than you might think. You know, just saying you're going to build 500,000 vehicles a year and actually doing it are two very different things.
Your logic sounds unimpeachable and your research is obviously thorough, but I'm looking at the leaderboard from April and look at the leaderboard from last week. And it seems like you've got a lot of different types of organizations on the chart, which are dissimilar. And some of them are grouped together. For example, on the new chart, you have GM and Ford, you know, as the leaders. And then in the contenders, which is, I guess, tier two, you've got Volvo Auto Leaves Annuity and like Hyundai Motor Group. And then Delphi is a tier one, is alone. And then ZF is alone. I mean, these are very different organizations. How can you say ZF or Delphi is a contender? I mean, explain that.
Yeah, that's actually the 2017 report.
Sorry, I had that inverted.
I think I can answer your question anyway, Alex, regardless of which one you're looking at. In terms of which companies we chose to include in the scoring, you know, there's a couple of factors. One, you know, we're looking at companies that are trying to, you know, companies and or partnerships, you know. So one of the things you'll see on here is that, especially this year, there's a number of cases where we've got multiple companies bundled together because they're part of a partnership. So, for example, Daimler and Bosch are working together to develop an automated driving system and a services platform. Similarly, the Renault-Nissan Alliance, BMW, Intel, and FCA are all working together. Volvo, Autoleave, Ericsson, and Zenuity. So what we looked for was companies that were putting together a full stack solution that includes the automated driving software, a suite of sensor suite, and vehicle platform, as well as the business model to actually deploy it commercially. So that's why, for example, Aurora, which clearly, you know, being led by Chris Urmson and Sterling Anderson, you know, they're focused primarily on just the software component, and as well as a lot of the other companies, you know, a lot of the suppliers that are down. You know, this year we added a new section to the report that we haven't had in the past, which is companies to watch that may or may not move up into the official rankings. And those companies, you know, are either startups that we are aware of but don't really know enough about what they're doing to be able to score them responsibly and all these different criteria, or they're companies that are specifically focused on particular parts of this. So, for example, Continental, you know, is not developing, you know, a full stack solution, but they are working with a number of these other companies to supply various components or subsystems into these full stack solutions. So that's kind of the break between where we how we grouped the companies that we did scoring for and those that were, you know, the other companies to watch group.
When you see two or three companies partnering, does that immediately in your mind and based on the methodology put them in a stronger position? Because, you know, on the face of it, partnerships can exude strength, but it doesn't always necessarily mean that it's a good thing. And so I've noticed that a number of the leaders now are companies that have come together and are partnering. And I'm just wondering where you put, I mean, why is it just because they're all partnering that they're leaders, or is there something else at play here?
To the degree I was able to, you know, I took a look at, you know, the individual companies that were part of these partnerships and what is their relationship, what's everybody contributing to it, and tried to take a look at the big picture. You know, so for example, you know, Daimler and Bosch, you know, ranked a little bit higher than BMW, Intel, FCA, because, you know, Daimler and Bosch have Daimler has always been a pioneer in deploying new technologies into the marketplace. You know, they were the first to do ABS and traction control and stability control and adaptive cruise. You know, so they've always been a leader in deploying these technologies. And most of the time it's been, you know, in cooperation with Bosch. I mean, Bosch and Daimler, you know, are, you know, they're both, you know, located in the same general vicinity in Germany, but they've had a very long-term working relationship as a supplier and customer. And now for automated driving, you know, that relationship is even closer. You know, it's more of a consortium than just a supplier OEM relationship. And, you know, the system that they're developing together is something that they intend to offer for sale to other companies if they want to use it. And then, you know, Bosch has also developed a strong relationship with NVIDIA over the last couple of years. You know, they were the first to announce that they would be producing an electronic control unit based on NVIDIA's Xavier platform that they just showed off at CES, you know, the sample parts of that. Some of those things factor into giving them maybe perhaps a little bit higher score than, for example, BMW and Intel and FCA. You know, I think FCA is, from what little we've been able to gather from what they're actually doing as part of this relationship between those three companies, is probably the weaker partner. But, you know, even BMW and Intel, they don't have as long a working relationship together. And so it's not necessarily clear that that relationship is going to be as likely to be as successful as the Daimler-Bosch relationship. So that's kind of, you know, those are some of the things that factor into my scoring. You know, so I do try to take a look at not just the individual companies, but how they work together as part of this to the degree we can.
How do government relations factor into the leaderboard? Because a lot of these companies have very different go-to-market strategies and are, you know, attacking it often in different countries where the environment is completely different on a policy level.
That's a good one. Government relations are definitely an important factor. The companies that have been in the automotive space for a long time obviously understand the regulators that they're working with, that they have to deal with. You know, here in the U.S. or in the EU or even in China, they have those relationships, and that's clearly been an influence on, especially here in the U.S., it's been an influence on some of the policies that we've seen come out over the past year, particularly over the last 6 months from the Department of Transportation and NHTSA. You know, there's been a pullback from the DOT in terms of what they want to try and regulate, at least for now. And, you know, most likely for the duration of the current administration, they will probably regulate nothing. But, you know, and in other regions, you know, the similar situation is true. So for Waymo, you know, for example, or, you know, for Baidu, you know, they probably have less influence on the DOT than, you know, an automaker does, or, you know, in the EU in particular, you know, Waymo might face some additional challenges relative to the automakers because of, you know, being part of Alphabet, and, you know, the EU regulators have taken a relatively dim eye on Google over the last several years. So that could put them in a more challenging situation. But Waymo isn't even really trying to do anything in Europe right now anyway.
I remember you and I, more than a year ago, I think, we had lunch. We talked about Tesla's, you know, massive amount of data collected, but the fact that it's not LiDAR level. So, you know, there's no one-to-one correlation between, say, a Waymo mile and a Tesla mile. And so there's probably some kind of discount for a Tesla mile gathered. And the relation between that and the ability to actually develop a level four solution.
You know, data quality and data quantity are two very different things. Clearly, you know, Tesla probably has more data quantity than anybody right now in terms of automated driving. But data for training these systems is only as good as the labeling and annotation you're able to put on that data. So having billions of miles of real-world data, if you can't go through all of that data and, you know, pick out the parts that are relevant and label all the objects in there, then it's not going to be very helpful in terms of actually training your AIs and your deep learning machines. So you've got to have really good data, really understand that data. I think that's an area where, you know, Waymo, for example, you know, they've got 4 million real world miles, but I think Waymo has the ability to really understand, you know, what's in that data and utilize it in a way that's useful. Similarly, you know, Intel, you know, has been doing a lot of work in that area. You know, they've got their data centers where they're ingesting and validating all of this data. So I think, you know, having good data is far more important than having a lot of data.
So, I'm, you know, disclaimer here, I am a firm believer that, you know, simulation is critical to developing self-driving cars, and I'm personally invested in it and because I think a lot of companies just have no other way of catching up in terms of miles driven using on their, you know, their AIs. a lot of these companies have a simulation solution. Some of them don't. To what extent do you think simulation can substitute for real?
It's absolutely crucial to these systems, especially if you're using a lot of deep learning systems, because you know when you're using AIs and neural nets, the reality is that there isn't just one path. I mean, with a traditional control system, where it's a rules-based control system. And you can walk through all of the potential paths in the software and figure out exactly all of the things that could potentially happen. All the different execution paths. But with an AI, that isn't possible. It's just not feasible to be able to do that because you don't necessarily know what paths anything is going to take. So the only way to validate a system like that is to do enormous amounts of simulation work. Waymo, for example, they're doing something like 10 million miles an hour of, or 10 million miles an hour or a day of simulations. Taking the data that they've got, and doing all kinds of different scenarios. Similarly, NVIDIA, at CES, they showed some pretty amazing things that they're doing with simulation, and they're using their rendering technology, their graphics rendering capabilities, to be able to take raw data that's been collected from vehicles and then actually create virtually an infinite number of new scenarios from that. Because of their ability to render the graphics, they can take a real world view that's been collected from the cameras and be able to modify the lighting conditions, modify the weather conditions, modify the road conditions, and modify the other vehicles around it and create an infinite variety of different scenarios and be able to crunch through those very rapidly. And so for anyone that is going to put these systems out in the real world, they're going to need to do a lot of simulation to succeed at that. All of these companies on this list, have a lot of, I think almost all of these companies on this list have a lot of processing capabilities, and they already do a lot of simulation work. Certainly all the OEMs do a lot of simulation work already for a wide variety of other things, for everything from crash protection, structural analysis, aerodynamic analysis. And, they're getting into doing all this other testing of the automated driving systems in these different scenarios as well.
How does Navya get on the contender into the contender section? For anyone who doesn't remember, Navya is the guys who put the shuttle out in Vegas and on day one had their fender bender. So explain that one, Sam.
Navya is a company that's actually got a pretty reasonable business model, and they're not trying to be everything to everyone. They have a go-to-market strategy that revolves around low-speed autonomous shuttles, could be used in certain very specific locations. They've got a variety of partnerships with various suppliers. They've got, at least for now, fairly small but growing manufacturing infrastructure. They've got over 100. I think about 120 of their ARMA shuttles in service right now in a variety of locations around the world, in Europe and Singapore, a couple of locations here in the U.S. Yes, that one in Las Vegas got into a fender bender when it didn't back up when it realized that truck was moving back towards it. It wasn't entirely the fault of the vehicle system, but given the scope of what they're trying to do, I think they have a very good strategy for achieving that. They're not trying to be an all-purpose vehicle. That's another factor in all of this, is looking at what are these companies trying to achieve and are they positioned to achieve it. They've got a strategy in place, go-to-market strategy. They've got a support and service strategy, and they've got, reasonable technology for what it is they're trying to achieve.
All right, by that standard, then why isn't a company like Voyage on this chart?
Voyage is one of those companies that I included this time in the companies to watch list because we haven't got enough information about them to rank them on all these other things. We reached out to them and they did not respond to our queries. So I didn't feel comfortable in scoring them. I've talked to the folks from Navya. I've talked to all these other companies about what they're doing. If a company is either taking a more limited approach in terms of just doing software or you know, they're a subsystem supplier, or they simply, you know, did not talk to us as Voyage and Zooks and a few other companies did, then I put them in those companies to watch. I put them in that companies to watch list. I didn't have enough information to give them a reasonable score, but the next time around, they could very well move up, you know, depending on what we understand about those companies at that point in time.
It's interesting to me that Jaguar Land Rover is under contenders. And what was it that stood out specifically about this company that pushed them into this? I know that's all relative, but I'm just curious as to what stands out.
They have expressed to me, you know, some of the things that they want to do, you know, that they are actively working with companies like Lyft, for example, to get to pilot their vehicles and get them on the road in mobility services. They want to operate as part of mobility services. They are testing a variety of vehicles in the UK now, and we'll soon be bringing them over here to the US. They have a production strategy. Overall, you know, I felt comfortable with where I scored them, kind of in the middle of the pack.
There's one question here that I think is really why we're all here. And that is, how the hell is Tesla so far back on this list?
I was waiting for you to ask that question.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously Tesla's done a really good job at sort of portraying themselves as being a leader in this space, and you really refute that. So, and I know there are legions of very angry young men on the internet wanting to hear you defend this decision.
I'm curious not just why it's under Challenger, but why it dropped, because it was in the contenders category, I believe, back in April.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, you know, it's important to keep in mind that these are all relative scores. You know, and so I go through each of these criteria and score each of the companies. You know, so I go through one row at a time in my table. I look at vision and I give scores, you know, to where I think all these companies rate relative to each other for their vision. Same thing for go-to-market strategy and their partnerships. A company dropping down the list does not necessarily mean they've moved backwards. Well, it may mean that, but it may also just mean that the other companies have moved forward faster. You know, looking at Tesla, for example, I gave them very high marks for vision. And Elon Musk has articulated an ideal vision for what he wants transportation to be in the future: electrified, autonomous, shared mobility services. Great. No, I have no issue with that. The go-to-market strategy, also relatively high score there. You know, the idea of the Tesla network and sharing the vehicles. You know, I think, you know, that's the approach that's going to need to be taken with automated vehicles, because if we don't dramatically increase the shared use of automated vehicles, we're not going to do anything to address the problems of urban congestion. But, you know, where they fall down is in areas like partners. You know, Tesla has very much a go-it-alone strategy, you know, aside from, you know, what supplier relationships they have, you know, with NVIDIA. And even that, you know, I think seems kind of strained. They are very intent on doing everything themselves, even when they may not necessarily have the expertise they need to do that. Similarly, their production strategy, we've seen all kinds of issues with their ability to actually produce vehicles, you know, reliably in volume and, you know, get them out the door. You know, their technology, I think, is also weak relative to everyone else. Even if you could do, you know, a highly automated system with just cameras and radar and ultrasonic sensors, which is a dubious proposition anyway, but even if you could, they're missing some vitally important things from their vehicles. You know, Elon Musk, you know, has said repeatedly that, you know, the vehicles they're building today, you know, their autopilot level 2 version 2 vehicles will be capable of fully level 5 driving in a couple of years with software updates. Well, that's just not true. Those cars will never, ever be capable of level 5 because they lack the redundancy that's going to be required. They lack systems to keep their sensors clean so they can see. And also, you know, the compute platform that they have is not sufficiently powerful to support level 5 capability. I mean, you know, look at what NVIDIA, you know, they with their Xavier chip, which is much more powerful than what Tesla is using today, they say even that's only capable of level 4. And if you want level 5, you're going to need to step up to the Pegasus platform, which is, you know, what, 12, 13 times more powerful than an Xavier. So, you know, I think that they're lacking in the technology. And then, you know, on their sales, marketing, and distribution, their limited distribution network, they have a lot of issues with trying to provide support to their current customers. You know, even with, you know, with the systems they have out there today, their product capability is lacking. Their quality and reliability is severely lacking, and their product portfolio is very limited. And also, finally, their staying power, you know, which is a category that, you know, is relatively lower weighted than other ones in this scoring. You know, based on their ability to stay in business, you know, their financial stability is just not there. I mean, you know, they've never been profitable on an annual basis. They've only had a couple of quarters ever in their history when they've been profitable. They burn cash at an enormous rate, far more than anybody else. And so, you know, all these things add up to a comparatively low score overall.
I think, Sam, you just guaranteed a few more angry tweets from Tesla fanboys.
But, I'm sure. But that's okay. I just mute them.
RIP your mentions. So this is a fantastic insight, Sam. I really appreciate you taking the time. Unfortunately, we are just about out of time here. But before we go, if people want to follow your work or find out more about this report, where can they find you? Maybe on social media, website, anything like that?
So you can find the report. If you're interested in the report, you can go to navigantresearch.com and click on the research tab there, and you can find it in there if you're interested in purchasing a copy. You can also find me in a whole bunch of places. Just Google my name and you'll find me on the Navigant Research blog, on Forbes, the Wheel Bearings podcast at wheelbearings.media. I write a monthly column for Automotive Engineering magazine, and occasionally contribute stuff in other publications as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining us. Alex, where can people find you this week?
Over at Disagree with Sam on Everything. No, I'm kidding. I'm totally joking. Thanks, Sam. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
It was the right thing to do, Sam, because I actually do respect your work.
I appreciate that, Alex.
I'm available on all platforms at AlexRoy144.
And Kirsten, anything from you this week?
Yeah, thanks, Sam, so much for coming on. And I can be found at Twitter, and I'm actually about to work on a story right now. Looks like Google's Waymo is taking self-driving minivans to Atlanta.
Oh, that'll be interesting to watch.
So Kirsten's hot on Waymo's latest market. So look for that story soon at Fortune. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. You can find me on Twitter at Tweetermeyer. Thanks again to our guest, Sam Abolsameed of Navigant Research. And join us next time for another episode of the Autonicast.